ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, joining me this week will be Douglas Yonas, head of exchange-traded products at the New York Stock Exchange. And I would say if you've ever seen one of the ETF issuer bell-ringing ceremonies on TV, where everyone's up on the podium with a gavel, you've probably seen Douglas. I feel like I see him on TV all the time. He's like the official MC for ETF issuer bell-ringings. But Douglas brings a unique perspective on ETFs. He was at Vanguard for 17 years and was heavily involved in building out their ETF business. And now with the role he has at the New York Stock Exchange, yes, he does these bell ringings, but his responsibilities are much more expansive than that because NYSE touches nearly every facet of ETFs. They've really taken on a consultative role within the industry. And so Douglas has a front row seat to everything occurring in the space. This will be a fun conversation. We're going to cover a number of topics, including his time at Vanguard, his ETF predictions, actively managed ETFs, and much, much more. Now, also this week, I'll be joined by Kevin Carter, founder and chief investment officer of EMQQ, which is the Emerging Markets Internet and E-commerce ETF. This has been a huge success. It's up to about $1.6 billion in assets and was actually one of the better performing ETFs in 2020. It was up about 80%. And there are all kinds of interesting stories wrapped into the space right now when you think about the recent Chinese stock delistings, Alibaba and Jack Ma, who's apparently missing. Of course, valuations always come up when talking emerging markets. The dollar. So there's a lot here, and Kevin's going to spotlight that ETF, and then we'll have a much wider conversation around emerging market stocks. Now, to start this week, I have ETF.com Sumeet Roy on the line. I just mentioned the dollar, which is getting a lot more attention this year. Just concerns around the potential for inflation and the impact that's having on the dollar. And obviously, if you're concerned about inflation, there are ways to play that directly through ETFs. TIPS ETFs come to mind. But Sumeet and I are going to focus on a few other areas where a weakening dollar can impact your ETF holdings. So let's jump right in and do that now.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
Just like with the stock, it's a function of the volume of the security. You can often put your limit order in between those two prices. The SEC is still concerned about how do you value cryptocurrencies.
Sumeet, Happy New Year. Great having you back on the podcast.
Happy New Year, Nate. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So look, I think the narrative around the U.S. dollar seems fairly straightforward right now, which is that we've had trillions of dollars pumped into the system, right? The Fed and fiscal stimulus, which it sounds like there's more stimulus on the way. But the thought is this could result in inflation, which would be a negative for the dollar. I guess first, you know, I always like starting with the basics. Do you maybe want to just describe at a high level this relationship between stimulus and inflation and the dollar?
Yeah, Nate, let me go through that. And there's a couple important drivers of all currencies, including the dollar. And the biggest long-term driver, like you said, is inflation and how it relates to purchasing power. In the end, most currencies are held to buy goods and services. So purchasing power, or the amount of goods and services you can buy with a given currency, that's going to be the most significant driver of that currency's value over the long term. And when it comes to fiat currencies like the dollar, purchasing power usually declines steadily over time because of inflation. When prices are rising, that's going to equal a reduction in the purchasing power of a single dollar. And that's largely by design. Central banks usually favor a modest, predictable level of inflation, something around 2%, because it encourages economic activity. And you can see how important purchasing power and inflation are to the worth of a currency when you look at places like Venezuela, Argentina, Zimbabwe. In those type of countries, inflation is so high that their currencies are losing 50% or more of their value in a single year. So the connection between inflation and the worth of a currency is pretty clear to see. Here in the U.S., inflation obviously isn't 50%. It's actually pretty low right now, around 1.6% based on the CPI. But expectations for inflation going forward, they recently hit the highest level since 2018, around 2.1%. And that's largely because of all the fiscal and monetary stimulus we've seen from the U.S. government. The trillions of dollars of stimulus that we've seen is going to equal more money sloshing through the economy, and that's leading to these higher inflation expectations. And it's those expectations that are driving the dollar down. But purchasing power is one driver of currency values. The other big one is interest rates, which affects the demand for financial assets. All else equal, higher interest rates, they're going to attract more capital into financial assets in a given country. So if rates are high in the U.S., that's going to encourage investors around the world to hold dollar-denominated assets like cash and fixed income securities over assets denominated in other currencies. And that's something that's worked in the favor of the U.S. dollar when interest rates were so much higher than they are now, you know, early last year and before that. The U.S. rates were much, much higher than what we saw in Europe and Japan. So the dollar was supported by that. But ever since March, when the pandemic struck, those interest rate differentials have completely gone away. Rates are zero in the U.S., just like they are everywhere else. So the dollar isn't benefiting from that anymore. And I'll also just point out that it's important to note that interest rates also feed back into the purchasing power of a currency, because higher rates generally dampen inflation pressures while lower rates increase inflation pressure. So that's why sometimes you see currencies appreciate in the face of high inflation, because if rates are going up also, there's the expectation that inflation is going to eventually come down.
And Sumit, what has the path of the dollar looked like recently, or even if we go back the past few years?
So if you look at the past few years, the dollar was sitting at a low point around 2008, 2009. That's when we had that commodity boom. Then the financial crisis struck, and we saw a big rush into the dollar around 2009. And then we saw an even bigger push higher in the dollar around the 2013, 2014 timeframe. We saw a big move up in the dollar, and that was when those interest rate differentials I talked about really moved in favor of the U.S. The Fed was hiking rates. Other central banks weren't hiking rates. And that really supported that dollar. And that was around the 2014 to 2019 timeframe. That was a really good period for the dollar. And then, of course, ever since the pandemic hit, it's been a slow slide down for the dollar, though we haven't gone all the way back to where we were, say, 5 years ago.
All right. So with that, let's talk ETFs and potential investment impact. And obviously, investors can play this very directly through currency ETFs, like the Invesco Currency Shares Euro Currency Trust, ticker FXE, or the Invesco Currency Shares Japanese Yen Trust, ticker FXY. That's if you want to bet on those currencies rising against the dollar. Of course, if you wanted to bet on the dollar, you have the DB US Dollar Index Bullish Fund, ticker UUP, very popular. And there are other options here, too. But what I want to focus on are sort of the stealthy ways the weakening dollar can impact a portfolio. And I think what's probably most applicable to investors is a weaker dollar could impact their international stock ETFs, right? Because let's say you own Japanese stocks and the yen is strengthening against the dollar. That's a tailwind for returns. Now, of course, we know some investors own currency-hedged international stock ETFs, where they're actually betting on dollar strength. Right now, the most popular currency-hedged stock ETF is the Xtrackers MSCI EAFE Hedged Equity ETF, ticker DBEF. Of course, I always think of the WisdomTree ETFs, right? The Europe Hedged Equity ETF, ticker HEDJ, and the Japan Hedged Equity ETF, ticker DXJ. But I'll just open this up to you. Talk about some of the considerations here for investors who own international stock ETFs.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, Nate. I'll just go over it in a little more detail. So when you own an international financial asset, you are making a tacit bet on currency movements. Say you have an ETF, like you said, Nate, and it owns Japanese equities. If those Japanese stocks go up 10%, that's great, but the ETF you own may or may not go up by that much. That's because the stocks that the ETF owns are denominated in Japanese yen. You have to convert those share prices back into dollars to see what your actual return as a U.S. investor is. So if the dollar appreciated against the yen in the time that you held the ETF, your gains will be lower than 10% since each yen in dollar terms is worth less than when you bought them. If instead the dollar depreciated against the yen, your gains will be higher since all those yen are now worth more in dollar terms. So if you own plain vanilla international ETFs, that's usually the equation you're dealing with. But maybe you don't want to be subject to the whims of the currency markets. Maybe you think the dollar is going to appreciate, so you don't want to deal with that, or you just don't want to deal with the uncertainty of where the dollar is going to go. If that's the case, then you can buy those currency hedge ETFs that you talked about, Nate, like DXJ for Japanese equities or HEDJ for European equities. These ETFs, they're essentially locking in the prevailing exchange rate. So your returns are then mostly a function of where the underlying stocks go. So you lose out versus unhedged ETFs when the dollar goes down in value, but you win out if the dollar goes up. Just keep in mind that there is a cost to putting these currency hedges on. It's not free. If rates in the currency that you're hedging are high, then those costs may actually be prohibitive. But in today's low-rate world, it's not as much of a consideration as it might be.
Okay, so this actually brings up a good question, because I know some investors argue that if you're hedging currencies, so you are in something like the WisdomTree currency hedged ETFs, you're actually making two bets. You're betting on whichever international stock market you're investing in, and you're betting that the currency in that market will decline versus the dollar. I guess, do you agree with that? Or do you think you're making two bets by owning unhedged international stock ETFs, or is this all semantics?
Well, first I'll say that forecasting currency movements accurately is nearly impossible.
Good
no
point.
One can really do that, yeah, on a consistent basis. But in both the hedged and the unhedged ETFs, you're making two bets either way. In the unhedged case, you're hoping that the dollar stays flat or goes down versus whatever currency your international assets are denominated in. In the hedged case, you're hoping that the dollar stays flat or goes up. Otherwise, you paid for your hedges for nothing. I guess you can say that, you know, with rates being low, the opportunity cost of hedging isn't that high right now. So if you'd rather take the currency movements out of the picture and completely accept the fact that you may be giving up some potential gains, then hedging might make sense. I think it's a legitimate thing to do, especially in the cases of the low yielding currencies, not so much in the case of something like emerging markets where hedging can be extremely expensive.
Well, and kind of a wild card here to consider when you talk about how difficult this all is, let's say a country's currency is falling, that could make the prices of their goods cheaper in other currencies, right? So theoretically, that could help the returns of companies exporting goods out of those,
exactly.
Just to throw in another variable. By the way, just a little trivia for you and the listeners. We talked about the WisdomTree currency hedged ETFs. Do you know what the largest currency hedged ETF currently is?
I don't. A few years ago, I'd have said definitely DXJ or HEDJ, but I have no clue what it is today.
All right. Well, it's a little bit of a trick question. It's actually a bond ETF, the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF, ticker BNDX, which I don't think some people realize that is currency hedged.
Wow. Yeah, that's right.
What about emerging markets? So I'm actually going to be covering this topic later in the podcast with EMQQ's Kevin Carter. But I think many investors believe these are essentially a dollar play, right? That when the dollar is weak, emerging markets are a pretty good place to be. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so emerging markets can be affected by the dollar, and in many ways they are. A weak dollar can be a positive for EM because a lot of emerging market economies, they're closely tied to commodity prices. So when the dollar drops, commodities get a bit of a boost on the margin since overseas buyers can afford more of them. At the same time, you know, many EM economies, they're export driven. So a weaker dollar helps there as their exports become more affordable when the dollar drops. And thirdly, emerging market companies and a lot of emerging market governments, they have a lot of dollar-denominated debt. And this becomes less of a burden when the dollar goes down. So when you put all that together, a depreciating dollar certainly helps emerging markets, but it's by no means the only factor that affects emerging markets. There's so many other underlying fundamental drivers that are even more important than the dollar. So it's just one thing to keep in mind, but it's by no means emerging markets is simply a dollar play.
All right, Sumit, a few minutes left. You are our resident Bitcoin and commodity expert. And I don't think there's any question. One of the reasons Bitcoin has run so hard is because of concerns over dollar devaluation. You look, Bitcoin's up like, 300% over the past year. Gold, that was up 25% last year. It's off to a little bit of a sluggish start this year, but again, strong year last year. Any quick thoughts on either of those as a hedge against the weakening dollar?
Well, I don't think they're good dollar hedges in the short term. They're just too volatile for that. They're not going to match the dollar one for one by any means. I mean, the volatilities of the assets are just too different. But if you look over longer time horizons, there is the case to be made that alternative assets like gold or Bitcoin could preserve or even grow in investors' purchasing power as the dollar depreciates. Gold has certainly proven itself in that regard over very, very long time periods, over, you know, many decades. Bitcoin could prove itself as a good store of value also, but it depends on enough people considering it to be a good store of value. It all comes down to collective belief when it comes to these alternative stores of value. If enough people believe it, it becomes self-fulfilling. But you have to think extremely long-term, not short-term. And then you have to accept that these investments have a high level of risk and volatility.
What about just broad commodities? So, you know, a lot of commodities are denominated in dollars. So theoretically, that would help as the dollar declines. I mean, how tethered are commodities to the dollar?
Like I said earlier, in the short term, they definitely... The dollar definitely has an impact because that cheaper dollar enables overseas buyers to purchase more commodities. So it definitely helps on the margin in the short term, but I would not call commodities a good dollar hedge. And there's so many things that get in the way of making a good investment in commodities, things like contango, things like roll cost. So if you look over long periods, commodities have actually done very, very poorly as an investment, other than certain things like gold, which are easy to store. So I would definitely push back against the idea that commodities are a good dollar hedge.
Well, Sumit, great stuff as always this week. This can be a complicated topic and get your head spinning a little bit. So I certainly appreciate your perspective. And I just want to reiterate something that you mentioned earlier, which is obviously trying to play the dollar is extremely difficult. I think our point here is just to emphasize that you want to understand how the dollar can impact your portfolio. I think that'll help you be better prepared and not have any surprises, really, regardless of which way it moves. But thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
That was ETF.com, Sumit Roy. My next guest is Douglas Yonas, head of exchange-traded products at the New York Stock Exchange. And I would say if you follow the ETF space, you probably already know who Douglas is. It seems like he's everywhere. But if you don't follow ETFs quite as closely, Douglas is a longtime industry veteran, and he currently serves in a unique role where he touches seemingly every aspect of the space. Now, of course, the New York Stock Exchange, they're referred to as the home of ETFs. They have nearly 80% of all exchange-traded product assets listed on their exchanges. And I'm now very pleased to have Douglas on the line with me from New York. Douglas, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Nate. I've been a longtime listener, so it's great to be a part of the program.
Well, right off the bat here, I have to ask you, how many bell ringing ceremonies have you participated in since you've been there?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I don't count. If I had to guess, I can tell you it's north of 100. One of the things, though, that I will say, it is something that just, it does not get old at all. I mean, walking in and out of the New York Stock Exchange every single day, it's awe-inspiring, it's humbling. You're literally walking on the same ground as our founding fathers, right? To walk in where George Washington stood, where Alexander Hamilton was, that feeling doesn't change. And to be up on that podium, you know, regardless of the 135 plus million viewers, it is just an inspiring moment. So it doesn't matter. Every time I'm a little nervous.
All right. Well, with that said, do you have a favorite or a most memorable story or two from a bell ringing ceremony?
You know, there's been so many crazy things that have happened. I once hosted the Blue Man Group. They were celebrating their anniversary year, and the Blue Men themselves were up on stage. If you've ever seen that show, it is just fun and fantastic. And I was hoping they'd break character. They never did. So a very odd ceremony where you're bringing someone through this really incredible experience, and they're not talking, and they have a handler, and they're kind of doing their act, if you will. But you know, there's very historic pieces of that ceremony. People don't realize there's a certain amount of time you're ringing the bell. It's very important to keep that tradition. The crowd below will let it be known if you make a mistake. And I tried explaining that, and it didn't really occur to me that once you hand it over to them, they'd have a little bit of fun with it. So they started doing some beats and noises with the bell, and the crowd did not appreciate it. So it was a very, for TV, it was probably great. For the floor of the exchange, maybe not so. So that was unique.
Well, how has the entire process been just during the pandemic?
It's been, you know, everybody says historic, and it's like that. I mean, we're faced with everything, right? I mean, the exchange itself is just the backbone of the capital markets, right? You need to ensure trading. It keeps consumer sentiment. It keeps business sentiment in line, right? We don't want to ever close the building, close the exchange. But we've had to go through these tremendous moments through the pandemic where we went electronic. The floor for the first time in history went electronic last year, where we ran it without people in the building. And not a fun event, something we want to repeat over and over, but it was something we just frankly had to do. And since then, we've been open, but, you know, we've had to run it with skeleton crews, skeleton shifts, you know, like everyone else, a lot of work from home. Fortunately, we live in a day and age, and over the last 5 years, there's been so much infrastructure build for the company where we know we can run these things remote just for business contingency, right, for planning. You test these things. You hope not to invoke them, but we've had to over the last year. Put it this way. I'm very excited about 2021, you know, let's say post-vaccination period when we can all come back in. It's the thrill of walking to that building is not lost. And even after 5.5 years, I can't wait to be back with all of my colleagues and, you know, experiencing that floor every day.
No question. I think we're all ready for that. And, you know, it's funny, even just flipping on CNBC or Bloomberg and you see the opening bell or the closing bell, there is something to that. It, you know, really bookends the day. Okay, so there's a lot I want to get to. And I actually thought we'd start by going back in time just a little bit before you arrived at NYSE. You were actually at Vanguard for 17 years. You were head of domestic equity indexing and ETF product management. And you left there in 2015 to take on your current role. I'd love to hear more about that experience in helping build Vanguard's ETF business, because if you look at, you know, the time frame you were there, that was a critical time in Vanguard's, you know, leading up to Vanguard's current success. And I look, some of the most popular ETFs today were launched while you were there and in that position. So can you just tell us more about that experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was really fascinating time because at the moment we were building these ETFs, none of us expected for the industry to be what it is today. So it wasn't as if any of us left our full-time jobs. If I really go back to like the first launch in 2001, none of us had an ETF in our titles or anything like that. We were part of just a big project team. I was coming out of the broker-dealer unit, and it was one of those things where, you know, I love the term voluntold, where a few of us were voluntold to a project and said, hey, these things are new and they're innovative and unique, and we knew we needed to be a part of it. We just didn't know how big it would be and if we needed to how much we needed to build. And so in the beginning, it was a lot of testing and coming together with really smart and, you know, motivated individuals to work on this sort of mega project. And it became one of those things where the project just kept growing. And then we said, well, why don't we start tackling this next thing? And then once we were live in the U.S. market, it was, well, someone should probably look at Europe. And I kind of raised my hand and said, I'd love to look at Europe and be involved. And so, you know, next thing you know, we're launching ETFs in the UCITS platform. And then, you know, it was, hey, what about Canada? That's a great opportunity. And I raised my hand and said, well, I'd love to be part of that. So here I was flying in and out of Canada and getting ready to launch ETFs there. And then it became a real push into Asia. And again, raised my hand and said, I'm willing to go do something new and unique. And so I had the opportunity for to be able to go out for Vanguard to Hong Kong. I lived there with my family about 3 years, and we launched the Hong Kong ETFs, and kind of all along the way supporting the Australia business was coming up and running. So without really realizing or planning it, somehow I was really given a fortunate opportunity to work on putting ETFs in just about every market on the globe. You know, without realizing this industry, I always knew it felt right. It felt great. There were so many positive aspects of an ETF versus a mutual fund. And so for me, it became a combination of building really unique products that were great for investors, right? That always feels good for the financial world, that you're doing the right thing for investors and you're building products that are going to help people save for college or save for a car or save for, you know, retirement. And then at the same time, for me personally, it was opportunities to be in new markets, develop new businesses, build new distribution channels, figure out marketing, you know, all these kind of neat business building opportunities. And I was fortunate enough to work at a great company and great people that they said, yeah, if you want to raise your hand, we'll give you an opportunity. And so it became this decade plus long, you know, varying roles across varying countries, but just a fantastic experience.
All right. I have to ask you, even though you probably signed some sort of airtight NDA, just knowing Vanguard, they like to play things close to the vest. Is there a story you can tell us from your Vanguard days that maybe hasn't seen the light of day, just something on the ETF side? And I'll give you a free pass if you want to skip that.
You know what I'll share, because I think it's important for all listeners and when they think about the ETF market. You brought up when you introduced, and I didn't think of it this way, but we did. I was on the project team that launched. If you go now and say, what are the top 10 largest ETFs in the world? I was on the team that probably launched the majority of the ones, at least for Vanguard's lineup. And what people don't realize, though, is they were not top 10 ETFs. They didn't leave shelves, you know, flying off the rack. Everyone needs to buy these ETFs. In the beginning, they were slow movers. A lot of us questioned how well they were doing, if they would survive. And I can tell you, we would have an annual sales conference. We'd bring all the salespeople together. And I remember being up on stage probably 3 or 4 years into what is now a top 5 largest ETF in the world, trying to kind of convince the sales teams that it's okay to go talk about this ETF. It belongs in investors' portfolio. Investors will want this ETF. And I was dealing with salespeople feeling like it was like a dead on arrival product. And so it's a real story of patience, if you will, in the ETF market, which is it can take a long time for a product to just people catch wind of it. People are aware of it. They realize what it can do. You hit the right investment cycle, et cetera. All these things can kind of come together. But I think, you know, for me, you know, when I tell people the story of being up on stage trying to convince a salesperson to even talk about what is now a top 5 ETF, people are a little shocked. But it's a real story about the ETF market. You just need to get in there and have a bit of patience.
Well, I have a great stat for you. So I was actually looking at this last week. If you look from 2005 to 2011, Vanguard had the top ETF launch in each of the years between that time frame. So for the respective years, if you look at current assets and products today, again, from 2005 to 2011, all Vanguard ETFs top by AUM, pretty remarkable. Okay, so let's talk about your current role. And my sense is many investors, when they think of the New York Stock Exchange, they picture people on the trading floor around computer screens, right? They think of the bell ringing ceremonies we talked about, but I'm not sure they immediately think of ETFs. So explain the exchange's role in the ETF ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you're right. We all have these images of the exchange, me included. I didn't grow up in the New York City area, but I visited the exchange a few times. And what they don't realize is, you know, over 5 years ago, the Intercontinental Exchange, it's a separate company, had bought out the New York Stock Exchange. And that team came in and took what was already an amazing place and brought it to, I mean, when I say the next level, I'm part of an organization. It's the most dynamic individuals I've ever worked with. It's an entrepreneurial spirit, top down. It is one of the greatest group of people I've ever come together. And that's what the New York Stock Exchange is today. It's a lot of really high, you know, also I think the misnomer, right, is people think about sort of the tough guy attitude and, oh, it's, you know, it's really rough and this. That's not it at all. I mean, you're dealing with some of the nicest individuals, high EQ, if you're into, you know, any of the emotional intelligence scores. These are some great individuals that seek success for themselves, their partners, et cetera. And when I was called by the exchange, they had called me in a number of years ago to say, hey, we want to think about the ETF business differently. And what I mean by that, I'm sure if you've ever charted percent of trading of ETFs, it's kind of an interesting chart. You only have to go back about 10 or so years where ETFs are trading at about 1% of exchange volume, whereas today it's 30%, 40% sometimes in volatile markets. So think about that. If you're the New York Stock Exchange and you have this tiny business, if you will, trading less than 1% of your volume, and then over the course of 5-6 years, it's growing at such a rate, it's become the question mark for you. Well, are we running it the right way? Is this the right thing? And so they had reached out to me as a builder of ETFs and a client of the exchanges and said, if you're going to do things differently based on where you think this market's headed, how would you do it? And so I had pitched to the exchange building out a consultancy business, meaning why not allow investment managers, asset managers who are going to think about the space, they're going to struggle like I did in almost every market. You know, you end up buying consultants, super expensive, you hire all these people. Sometimes you have to, you know, buy people out to come and join you to figure out a market. It's a long, time-consuming experience, and it can be really expensive, and that can change your business from being profitable to no longer being worthwhile. And I said, why not let me bring in some people that really understand the ETF business, that really can help as a consultant, and will change the way that we do things at the exchange, and we'll become partners instead of a transactional business. We'll be friends to the businesses. We'll be helpful. We'll be consulting. And so that's what we've done over the last 5 years. When someone thinks about launching ETFs, they don't realize it's not all the giant asset managers like a Vanguard or a BlackRock or a State Street. In many cases, it's small teams of people, sometimes one person with a great idea or a small advisor with 2-3 SMA accounts, and they're thinking, hey, can an ETF vehicle solve a problem for me and my business? Can I reduce expenses? Can I increase tax efficiency, et cetera? And I wanted them to be able to pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm a one-person show or I'm a two-person show. Help me. And to be able to turn around and say, no problem, we're here for you. And that's what we do. We will help somebody bring their entire business. We'll work with them through every step. We'll help them pick their external, you know, partners, outsource where they need to outsource, insource when they need to. And we supply them with all the tools, everything they need. And then we bring them onto the exchange and we help them grow their business. So it's a really exciting shift. And it's something none of the exchanges had ever done before. But boy, is it fun and it's exciting.
Douglas, because of that consultative role, look, you have a front row seat to everything going on in the ETF universe. And there's no question you believe NYSE can be a critical part of an ETF success. But what do you think is the overall recipe for ETF success right now? Because we know it's a highly competitive space. Obviously, there's a ton of innovation. And so what do you think separates the success stories from the disappointments?
Yeah, You know, Nate, I've written, you know, for those that are listening, I've written a couple articles on this on LinkedIn. So I'm going to, I won't go as deep as those because I know we're limited on time, but there is no one perfect recipe, but there are certain things that you can do to make sure you're successful. The first is making sure you don't really drive up your costs out of the gate. I mentioned that patience is really a virtue in this space, meaning a lot of times, sometimes, you know, people will jump in and say, hey, do I need to hire a whole bunch of marketing people and buy up ads and buy this and buy that? And they end up spending so much of their chance for profitability when they can lean on others. So that was part of our platform. We've built this big distribution model. People who list their ETFs with us, we do media services. We build videos for them. We build campaigns. We distribute it. We build a social media platform. We build a website, homeofetfs.com. So we can do that and really help people save costs and money. But patience, as I mentioned in my story, patience for growth is super important, and making sure people don't get in over their head. If there, you know, some real great smart people out there that come up with ideas that just hit, you know, lightning in a bottle, right? And they're just perfectly timed to the market. Sometimes that happens, and that's fantastic. And you see that with 5G. We've got these SPAC ETFs, perfect timing for SPAC ETFs. We've got ESG products that just hit the market. You know, we've had work from home ETFs. We've had online shopping ETFs, right? These all were perfectly timed, really bright individuals that bring them out at the exact right time. That's fantastic. That's a perfect recipe. It's just not realistic that we're all going to be able to do that. And so a recognition that sometimes slow and steady really does win the race here. And then for those products, you want to make sure you're thinking about how do they fit in an investor's portfolio? Where do they belong? At what ratio do they belong? And, you know, what's a realistic sales target? And how do you make sure advisors and investors know about your ETF? And when you start to answer all those questions, that's when you put that recipe together. So, again, I'm kind of giving high level, but for those that want to really get deep, if you're thinking about ETFs, just reach out to me or my team, whether it be through a social media platform, or you can even email us, etf@nyse.com. We can go deep with you and your business strategy, but those are some of the key things that have helped people make sure they're successful.
If we look at the broader ETF landscape, out of everything that you're seeing right now, everything that you're involved with, what has you most excited?
So there's a couple of spots that are just tremendous growth areas. The first is really in the ESG space. There's so much greenfield and green space there with respect to ways in which you can construct equity portfolios, fixed income. We've barely touched green bonds and some of those places. And, you know, given where the pundits are talking about potential, you know, administrative infrastructure spending for our country, that's probably a great spot that we're really excited about. The other spot is active management. We know that, you know, any way you cut it, it's one of the largest parts of our investment industry is active managers, stock pickers that are picking the actual names in a portfolio that are not following an index. They've done extremely well in the last few years. Some of the best active managers have done incredible throughout 2020. And we have created a brand new structure where they can finally be an active manager in an ETF without having to disclose their portfolio every day. So we know that's going to be tremendous. And, you know, the third spot that I think about is I'm just going to label it conversion, but it's fund managers or, as I mentioned, advisors running SMA accounts that are looking at the ETF and realizing, you know, I'm running, let's say, four or five model portfolios for my practice. It's really expensive. And if I convert those four or five model portfolios into an ETF, even if they're just for me and my clients, and I'm not planning to sell them elsewhere, maybe others will pick them up, great, and I can outsource a CIO model, and that gives me an opportunity. But just for myself, by converting these models to an ETF, I can increase tax efficiency and I can lower costs for my clients as an advisor. That's been a real wake-up call, and it's at the earliest of stages in my mind. And we're seeing more and more of them come to market. And it's fantastic because they can convert their models and, like I said, save their investors a lot of money. Even if they're the only ones buying their own model, it's still a great, you know, win-win. It's less expensive for the investor, which means they save more money in their pockets. And as you talk about on the show, the more you compound growth year over year, the more impactful it is. So, you know, really exciting space.
Going back to active ETFs, this is obviously getting a lot more buzz now. I think every year it was like this was going to be the year for active ETFs. Didn't happen. But finally, last year, we did see a meaningful uptick. Do you think more issuers are getting involved here because that's where the white space is? That if you look, plain vanilla ETFs are spoken for. I think a lot of the smart beta products are spoken for. And so active is really where there's room to operate and maybe differentiate. And then you add to that, you mentioned the non-transparent structure. I know NYC has a partnership with Natixis. What's driving this interest in active?
Yes, I mean, you're right. The New York Stock Exchange, we own a model. We own it outright. It's our own patents and our own IP that we offer. It's not the only model out there, and we've never been a believer of there's only one right solution. So, again, consultancy-based operations. So firms can come in. We'll talk to them about all the pros and cons of every single model. We happen to offer one if they want it. You're right, Natixis is a licensee. You have American Century Live, they're a licensee, and a lot of other large firms have announced they plan to use the New York Stock Exchange's model. What it is that it offers an active manager, an active fund manager, the ability to run an ETF without showing what they're holding every single day. That's been the problem up until 2020. You've always had to say at the end of every day, here's my holdings, which doesn't work out really well for someone who's an active manager, right? Someone can just copycat their portfolio or they can try and front run it. So for those firms, you know, the largest active managers, they can now come into this space, take advantage of tax efficiency, take advantage of a global distribution model, a less expensive structure, and really rewrap exactly what they're doing, but offer it to more investors. And I think about that even for me as an owner of some active mutual funds. It's hard to get to those funds. It's hard to align them with a traditional portfolio. It's hard for me to use, you know, my iPhone and access those funds. But if they're in an ETF wrapper, boy, it changes things pretty quickly. And so it's a real opportunity for, you know, all the big name asset managers to get into the ETF space. You're right. It all just happened. I mean, we launched mid-year 2020, and there's over $1 billion in that space right now. So it's by far one of the biggest opportunity areas. If you're a mutual fund company, if you're a manager of active funds, small SMAs, I mean, this is really an opportunity of a decade for you to be able to step in at the very beginning of growth, at the very beginning of an opportunity. I mean, this is, like you mentioned, going back to 2001 and I launched my first ETF. What would it feel like to go back in time now as an asset manager knowing what you know? That's today. That's January 2021 for active ETFs. So for me, I think it's probably one of the most exciting things that we have in our hands right now from a growth opportunity in our industry.
All right, just a couple minutes left. And instead of going back in time, let's look forward. And I want to ask you, give us one big ETF prediction over the next 5 or 10 years. This can be anything, assets, issuers, products, whatever you'd like, but give us one big prediction.
Well, my big prediction is that every asset manager will have at least one ETF. I think it's going to be hard to just walk away and ignore what is really a better wrapper for asset management. And, you know, that wrapper comes in, you know, lower costs and additional tax efficiency. And it also comes in the form of global distribution. I think a lot of people don't realize if you list an ETF on the New York Stock Exchange, me and my team, we can actually help you sell that ETF into Asia, throughout the global markets, through Latin America. So if you're an asset manager and you're thinking, hey, how do I sell to a U.S. investor? You know, by listing with us, we can actually sell to global investors. So it's going to be harder and harder, I think, to be an asset manager and not have at least one ETF in the market, which is a big deal. There are a lot of asset managers out there. But like I said, there's just so much opportunity. And, you know, I think about whether it's my generation, the next generation, my kids, as I'm working with my kids to teach them financial literacy, what am I doing? I'm opening up a small account for them, and I can teach them to invest. And, you know, when you're dealing with very small amounts of money, right, the ETF is perfect. They can buy one share, two shares, and they have immediate investment diversification. And so as I work with a 16-year-old around, hey, you've got some babysitting money, why not invest it? And we've got the platform. You know, all these brokerage firms, they went commission-free for ETFs over the last year. No cost to open an account. So, you know, I can sit with my son and my daughter and have a conversation about how to spend $50 and, and actually invest in a global ETF that has diversification, that has low cost, that has tax efficiency. It's an incredibly powerful tool that I think really is transforming investing for the next 5 to 10 years.
All right, about a minute left before I let you go. I have to ask you, and listeners will laugh at this, do you have any strong views on a Bitcoin ETF and whether one will be approved? Of course, with ICE, over the past couple of years, I've seen some headlines around crypto. You don't have to speak to that, but any thoughts on a Bitcoin ETF?
Look, it's something we have been working on for at least my entire tenure at the New York Stock Exchange. So it's something we continue to work on. Whether you believe in crypto or not, and whether you think people should own it or not, the thing that concerns me is that the way people are accessing crypto ETFs today is in the OTC markets, and that's probably for another show. But the over-the-counter markets are effectively they're not exchanges, right? It's not the protection investors need when they're thinking about investment products. So whether we believe in crypto long term or not, we at the New York Stock Exchange, we're going to continue to work on this because I do think it's a problem that needs to be solved for, which is if we don't allow an investor to access an ETF in a regulated investment vehicle, something that has oversight by the SEC, that has oversight by the exchanges and listed on the New York Stock Exchange, they're going to access it through different means. And we've all seen the horror stories in that. And so, you know, I think just from an investor protection, it's important that we keep working on it. So I can tell you, me, my team, we're not going to let this one up. And, we hope for success. We have a new administration coming in, some new leadership at the SEC. And so, I never say never.
I could not have said it better. You and I should do a full show on that topic. I think it'd be a lot of fun. But Douglas, really appreciate you taking the time. Again, we will definitely have to do this again. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks for having me.
That was Douglas Yonis, head of exchange traded products at the New York Stock Exchange. I'm now joined by Kevin Carter, founder and chief investment officer of EMQQ, the Emerging Markets Internet and E-commerce ETF, which just has about $1.6 billion invested and was actually one of the better performing ETFs in 2020, up about 80%. Kevin is now on the line with me from San Francisco. Kevin, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, great to be here.
All right, so I'm not sure if you saw this, but one of my big predictions for 2021 is that emerging market stock ETFs will finally turn the corner after serial underperformance for over a decade now. But I've got to tell you, I was looking, so EMQQ has actually bucked that trend. You're beating the S&P 500 since your ETF launched in 2014. So I want to start there. How in the world have you done that?
Well, EMQQ captures the real growth in emerging markets, which is the growth of the consumer. But it also captures two other things that are part of that growth, which are first, the computer in form of a smartphone. We take computers for granted, but the reality is most of the world's never had a computer until they get their first ever smartphone. And that smartphone is bringing with it the third part of the story, which is the internet, which is something we've also taken for granted. So you've got billions of people moving on up, becoming consumers, and at the same time getting digitized and joining the digital revolution.
Okay, so talk about the construction of the ETF then, because again, if I look at EMQQ compared to broad emerging market ETFs, you look at 2020, again, EMQQ was up about 80%. Most broad emerging market ETFs were only up about 20-25%. So talk more about how holdings are selected and what the differentiator is here.
Sure. Well, we own every publicly traded internet or e-commerce company in emerging or frontier markets, Alibaba, Tencent, companies like that. And we own all of them. And right now, we own a little less than 100 companies, but that list is growing. And to be honest, the broader emerging market ETFs, I don't think are things that people should use. If you look under the hood at what's in a Vanguard or an iShares broad emerging markets ETF, There's just way too much invested in the legacy economy, the state-owned enterprises, the government-owned banks and oil companies that really aren't trying to grow shareholder value in a traditional sense. So we give you, you know, what I think of as the best exposure to the, what I think is the best growth story in the world today, which is the emerging markets internet story.
You mentioned Alibaba. One of the top holdings in EMQQ is currently Alibaba. And of course, that company's made a lot of headlines recently. There's talk of China nationalizing the company. The founder, Jack Ma, is apparently missing. And, you know, looking at the ETF's composition, Alibaba is about, 6-7% of the ETF's holdings. China overall is about 60%. What kind of risks does this pose? Like how concerned are you?
Well, the world's a risky place, and it will remain so. But I'm not really worried. In fact, I take comfort, to be honest. Right now, Alibaba in particular is under siege. It's being attacked by the U.S. government with talks of delisting, with talks of banning some of its offerings. And it's also under attack from the Chinese government. There's questions about anti-monopoly rules. There's the failed Ant Group IPO. And Jack Ma, I don't think, is missing. Jack Ma is laying low. Jack said some things that didn't go over well with the Chinese government, and I think he's just trying to stay out of the spotlight for a little while. But there's no doubt that the Ant Group platform, that's Alibaba's fintech subsidiary, is a very disruptive company and has been basically vacuuming up the Chinese financial system. Perhaps it was happening too fast, and the regulators wanted to make sure they had it under control. But I don't think nationalization is an outcome that's likely at all.
You mentioned delistings, the recent delistings of Chinese stocks. Is that something you're watching? Is there any negative impact here for the ETF?
Well, there's negative sentiment elements to that. I don't think that the U.S.-listed Chinese companies are going to get delisted. There's really two different groups that are in the crosshairs of the U.S. government. The first, those companies linked to the Chinese military, including the phone companies and the oil companies. We don't own those, and I don't think investors should invest in them anyhow. So that's the first list. But then the second and longer list is any Chinese company that's listed here, and that has to do with a 20-year-old rule that we did not enforce for two decades about the PCAOB accounting review process. I don't think those companies are going to get delisted. I think that the Chinese government knows they need to get in line with the PCAOB process, and I think they'll do that. And there's a three-year cure period for these companies. So even with the bill passed and signed by the president, these companies would have to be out of compliance for 3 years before they were delisted. And I'm confident they'll work out something between now and then. But even if they are delisted from the U.S., it doesn't matter to us. We will own them wherever they trade, and the likely place they'll end up is Hong Kong.
All right. Another question that I've seen on the risk side of the equation, and this is something that I think we've heard for the past year or so, but what about the COVID pandemic? Because I think the average investor looks at a first world country like the U.S. and they see really all of the challenges that we've had, and they wonder, well, how are some of these emerging economies that lack the resources we have, how are they dealing with this? So how big of a risk is COVID in emerging economies right now?
Well, I think it's a big risk almost everywhere, and I have been concerned. You know, there are parts of emerging markets, very densely populated slums with poor sanitation, poor health care, where you might have five people sharing 150 square feet, so this, you know, social distancing is not really practical. So I've been worried about the human toll. China, as you pointed out earlier, is the biggest part of the EMQQ story, and of all economies in the world, all countries in the world, China has the COVID under control, not eliminated, but they've used mobile phone-based contact tracing to, I think, handle this better than anybody, and they've continued to have outbreaks, but those outbreaks have been limited to hundreds of cases, not hundreds of thousands of cases. So in the case of China, I think they're stabilized. They were the only economy in the world to grow last year. They looks like they'll have about 2% plus GDP growth, the only major economy to show growth in 2020. India, the second largest population in emerging markets, has a very young population. So while the case numbers are high, they've had lower death rates than the rest of the world. So there's no doubt a very big human toll. But in terms of the emerging markets internet story, as we've seen here, you know, when COVID comes to town, people do even more stuff on their smartphones. So it's really and uncomfortably for me to talk about, it's given a big boost, I think, to the EMQQ story.
All right. Well, let's get to the topic that I think everyone wants to hear about, which is valuations, which is always a topic when discussing emerging markets. You know, look, I've heard for a long time now that broad emerging markets are undervalued. And as I mentioned at the top, you look at performance, that hasn't really mattered. Now, your ETF is clearly different, just given the focus on tech. So I guess, what are your thoughts on broad EM valuations and then specifically with the companies that EMQQ owns, which have run pretty hard recently?
Sure. Well, I think that the broad emerging markets indexes and the funds that track those indexes, I think those are the biggest value trap in the world. People time and time again look at the PE multiple. It's way less than the S&P 500's PE. The GDPs are growing faster, and so people think, gee, I can get all this growth at half the price. Well, if you really understood what Petrobras, the Brazilian state-owned oil company, was, and the Agricultural Bank of China, if you understood what these state-owned enterprises were, you probably wouldn't think they're cheap at 10 or 12 times earnings at all, and in fact, probably shouldn't want to own them even if they sold for a fraction of that amount. So I'm not optimistic about the broad emerging markets indexes based on what looks like an attractive PE multiple. In terms of the emerging markets internet space, we have had a good run, as you mentioned, but you know, I'm a long-term investor. I don't make short-term stock market predictions, and the only multiple that I care about is the PE versus the growth rate, the PEG ratio. And while the PE for the group is getting up close to 40 on the forward earnings, the revenue growth is about 30%. So the PEG ratio is about 1.3. And, you know, in a world where everything's relative, that's about half the PEG ratio of the U.S. tech stocks. It's maybe a third of the PEG ratio of the S&P 500. So, and with the risk-free rate at basically zero, I'm not concerned about valuations. I mean, certainly, if you're, you know, a long-term investor, I'm sure that we'll have a 20 or 30% correction at some point in the sector, but I'm not worried about current prices for investors that have a 3 or 5 year time frame.
Just a couple minutes left here. You mentioned broad EM, you know, essentially being value traps. I'm curious, how do you think investors should approach the emerging market space overall? And let's take this from the ETF side. You have EMQQ. Obviously, you're going to be preferential to that. But is that a core holding? Do you hold EMQQ? Do you complement that with other EM holdings? Just high level, how should investors approach the emerging market space from an ETF perspective?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And as you pointed out, I obviously have a conflict in this regard. I am biased towards EMQQ. And I've also become pretty radicalized in my thinking about this. I would not have said the same thing that I'll say now 5 or 10 years ago. You know, historically, we've told people to use EMQQ as a satellite to a core EM holding. And initially, I told people to, you know, use the Vanguard Emerging Markets ETF and then pair it up with EMQQ. But then I would sort of, you know, utter under my breath, you'll have less money in 5 years, but it cosmetically might look better to you. So I don't, you know, I really do believe that investors with a long-term horizon, and any investor, should have this group of companies in their portfolio. This is the tip of the spear of growth in the world, and it will continue to be for a long time. But if you have to use a broad emerging markets ETF, the one that I would use is XSOE, which is a WisdomTree emerging markets ETF. I have nothing to do with WisdomTree or that fund, but it basically is a broad emerging markets ETF that leaves out the state-owned enterprises and all the corruption and inefficiencies that come with them. And it's done, if you look at the long-term performance, our offering has been the best performer, but the number two best performer is simply leaving out the state-owned enterprises with XSOE.
Well, Kevin, excellent perspective as always. Congratulations on all the continued success. We've had you on the podcast for several years now, I think going back to the year you launched, and it's been just amazing to see how this ETF has grown and really gained an audience. So congratulations on that, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot.
That was Kevin Carter, founder and chief investment officer of EMQQ. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through etfprime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by Franklin Templeton's David Mann. He's going to give us his full 2021 ETF outlook. And then ProShare Scott Helfstein will spotlight their MSCI Transformational Changes ETF and discuss thematic investing. Until then, have a great week, everyone.